Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Welcome, friends. This is Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Thank you for joining me today. It is Friday. It is Arbor Day. And I got to tell you, what has taken place in the demilitarized zone between what you and I recognize as North and South Korea on the Korean Peninsula is nothing short of extraordinary. There really probably are not words sufficient to articulate the advances made today so quickly by two men willing to literally step across a division, a dividing line that has existed now for more than half a century. And North and South Korea, if you have not yet heard the news, have basically agreed to complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. They have declared that they intend to bring an official end to the Korean War by the end of this year. Now, let's note that in order for that to happen, the United States, China, and the United Nations would need to be involved. And so we now greatly anticipate the meeting that U.S. President Donald Trump will have with North Korean, we still call him a dictator, right? I mean, he's still a dictator, Kim Jong-un. Now, I think the real hero in this whole story and the person for whom we need to be ardently praying is South Korean President Moon Jae-in. He is quite the diplomat. I think he recognizes that no one on earth, including China and the United States, care nearly as much about the Korean Peninsula and its people as do he and Kim Jong-un. So I think what we're talking about here is a genuinely Korean solution to a problem that has been international and escalating. So here's basically what happened. Kim Jong-un met with South Korean President Moon Jae-in on the southern side of the demilitarized zone in what we would call the Border Truce Village. I think that's pretty cool to have that they even have a Border Truce Village. They have a peace house. Some have met in the peace house in the past. This actually made really significant history. This is the first time the North Korean leader has crossed the southern border since the cessation of hostilities in what we regard as the end of the Korean War in 1953. But that wasn't really the end of the war. It was simply like a stalemate, like a we're not going to actively shoot at each other anymore moment in time. So they've been in this pause, they've been in this war pause since 1953. And so that's where we're at. It really is extraordinary. You're probably going to hear the mainstream media today fumbling for words as well. This is the first summit in more than a decade. The two sides announced that they are going to seek an agreement to establish permanent and solid, what you would I would understand as lasting peace on the Korean Peninsula. They have promised to pursue mutual military arms reductions, to cease hostile acts toward one another, to fortify the border into a peace zone, not just a demilitarized zone, but an actual peace zone, to seek multilateral talks with other countries that would include the United States and China. And in the midst of all of this, in a first ever press conference in front of the world media, Kim Jong-un said, quote, "We are one nation. We cannot be separated. We share the same blood. We are living with each other. We are brothers." One of the things that was promised here was the reunification of families who have been separated, some of them for more than six decades. They signed a guest book together, and in it, Kim Jong-un wrote, in the peace house, he wrote, "A new history begins now." Indeed, I think that's really true. They've agreed to visit one another again. They displayed signs of unity and peace, shaking hands on both sides of the borderline. And they planted a commemorative pine tree from 1953, which was the year the Korean War armistice was signed, and they planted that tree at the border at the Truce Village there on the border. So it's a day that we can talk about war and peace. And we can talk about there being literally a time for every event under heaven. It's a wonderful time for us to talk about what makes for peace. It's a wonderful time for us to talk about the influence of the Christian church, particularly in South Korea. For those of you who are not aware, Christianity is on fire. Christians are on fire in South Korea. It is a very positive expression of the Christian faith. They are some of the most prayerful Christians I've ever met in the entire world. And this is the day for which they have been praying in terms of their own country and the possibility of the reunification of their own families. And certainly, from their view, the opening of North Korea to the gospel of Jesus Christ. Now, that's not something that Kim Jong-un certainly said that he was open to, but you and I both know that once we start talking about the free flow of people over that border, we're going to also be talking about the freer flow of the gospel. So we want to pray today for ministries that are reaching North Korea with the gospel. We certainly want to be praying for Christians in North Korea. We want to continue praying for the people in North Korea who are in literal bondage and privation because of this three generations of authoritarian dictatorship of the Kim family. And even as we talk about unity and reunification, we also need to recognize that there are many things that divide people on the Korean Peninsula. And so although today is historic and astonishing in many ways, there are still many barriers to the actual permanent and lasting peace that I think particularly South Korean President Moon Jae-in is very much hoping to foster here. The significance of this event, of this day, really cannot be overstated. And we want to say prayers for this kind of mutual pursuit of peace. These are prayers that have been, as I said, rising for generations. But in the midst of this very historic moment, I also want us to remember that North Korea is a repressive and reprehensible regime. It was just yesterday that the parents of American student Otto Warmbier filed suit against North Korea for the imprisonment, torture, and death of their 22-year-old son. You might remember the very sad saga of Otto Warmbier, who was arrested during a student trip to North Korea and suffered greatly at the hands of the North Koreans. He was released from prison and shipped back to the United States of America in a coma, only to die just a couple of days later here in the United States with his family. So we need to remember that all peace this side of heaven is relative peace. And even the kind of peace that we might be seeing emerge is not going to come quickly enough for the millions of people who have already died under the repressive regime of the Kim family. So let's be mindful of that as we, you know, as we see these politically impactful pictures of these two Korean men standing with arms raised in victory at the table of diplomacy. Let's also remember that one of them is a person who fears and loves God and is with us in terms of our faith expression. And the other is clearly not. He is the dictator of a communistic regime that is intentionally and aggressively atheistic. So let us not ever forget that what we're dealing with here are two very different worldviews that divide two very different people groups, even those people who share the same Korean blood there on the Korean Peninsula. So continuing prayers today for that situation and scenario. Hey, there's all kinds of breaking news that I would like to cover today, all kinds of things in the headlines that I won't be able to get to. So over the weekend, and actually on Facebook Live immediately after today's show, I'll pick up some stories that we would cover here if we had more time to do so. So you can always find me at reconnectwithcarmen.com and on Facebook. I'll do a Facebook Live immediately following today's Connecting Faith program, and we'll talk about the Cosby verdict, and we'll also talk about the situation with pastors in the country who have been unable to retain their positions of leadership because of accusations in the past. So we're gonna talk about accountability in leadership and what we do when our when the people who we have followed fall. But right now, I got to take a quick break. When we come back, I will be joined by my longtime friend and colleague, William Vanderblumen. He is the head of Vanderblumen Search. He is a leader who is equipping churches for effective ministry in our radically changing culture. He's got a new book out called Culture Wins, and he's going to be here to talk about it in just a minute. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. We'll be right back. Carmen LaBurge, you're listening to Connecting Faith. Welcome back. I am thrilled to introduce you to William Vanderblumen. He's an entrepreneur, a pastor, a speaker, an author, and CEO and founder of Vanderblumen Search Group. He's a regular contributor to both Forbes and Fortune. He is frequently asked to contribute to many media outlets on staff culture and team building, and he's here today to talk with us about his new book, which is called Culture Wins. You can follow William on Twitter at W. Vanderblumen, and you can follow his firm at Vanderblumen SG. That's for Vanderblumen Search Group. Hey, William, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thanks, Carmen. Great to be with you, and really, gosh, so glad to see what you're doing with this ministry and how it's growing. Awesome.
Oh, thank you so much. So for my listeners, William and I go way back. We've known each other a long time through lots of phases of life and ministry. And William, as I was reading this book, man, just right at the beginning, you're just very transparent. You tell your story in the book. And although we could sort of like spend our time running through the accolades of Vanderblumen Search Group and all of the things that you've won in terms of culture, You share in the book that there's a prehistory that's important. And so why don't you just share that with folks?
Oh, yeah, sure. And I'll try and keep it short. I'm a rambler, or as I say, a recovering preacher. So, the story actually begins, your listeners will like this, with me pulling into the campus of Princeton Seminary and opening my door like a deer in the headlights. And there welcoming me were three people, and one of those three was Carmen. And so going all the way back, we met back then, had a 15-year run in ministry after seminary, and then a brief stint in the corporate world, and then decided through watching how well the corporation I worked with did their succession and how poorly churches had done succession, that maybe we should try and build a solution for churches, which has now turned into faith-based organizations and companies that are values-based, to help them find staff more quickly and do succession. So started on my own, started in 2008. Adrian and I had just gotten married, and I came home and told her, I think I'm supposed to quit my job and start something new for churches. And I'll never forget, she looked at me and she said, "That's because churches love new ideas, right?" And for some reason, we said, let's do it. It was in 2008, which was just a brilliant time to quit your job. But nonetheless, things grew, and we started hiring people. And in the beginning, it was just me. And when you had staff meeting, it was just me. And I don't know if your listeners have ever experience this, but staff meetings of one go exceedingly well. Like, everybody gets along, and the meeting ends on time, and there's no time wasted.
I was going to say, they're also very fast.
That's right. So, you know, once we started hiring people and growing, we had 2, 3, 4, 5 people, and we looked up, and we realized, you know, we really like working together, and we ought to just hire people that are going to continue that like working with us. And that set us down a road. I had sort of, you know, been reticent to do any kind of mission, strategy, vision. I mean, we have a business plan, but all the sort of 5-year strategic plan and all that, I'd been a little bit burned on. And so my team said, well, why don't we talk about what we value culturally? So it's not that, like, we're real clear on the goal of what we want to get done, but what if we focused on how we want to behave while we're getting that done? And that led to a really interesting conversation and our very first sort of offsite where we rented a room at a Marriott, like a conference room, and that was big dollars. Like, oh my gosh, we have arrived. We've rented a conference room with a dry erase board. Pretty amazing. And in that time, we started a conversation that led – it started with a question. It was more primitive then than now. We sort of refined it. But the question is basically this, and I think this will help your listeners. If they're thinking about trying to define their culture, ask this question. We said, when we are functioning at our very best, what do we as a team do together that's common to us but uncommon to the other teams we see around us? So that it's not something common like, oh, we do excellence. You know, everybody says excellence. I'm still waiting to find the company that has as their value mediocrity, right? It just doesn't exist. But through a long process, which we outline in the book, we landed on 9 cultural values, and then we began driving them through the organization. It wasn't a set plan. It wasn't something I was an expert in. And as we assigned the job of culture to a person on our staff, you know, things started happening and clicking, and all of a sudden our staff was entering us in contests and we were winning awards. And then, William, you need to, you know, tell us how you built this culture, which made me drop back and say, how did we build this culture? And so when the publisher approached us and said, would you write this book, we really sort of reverse engineered things and said, how did we get where we are? And we also looked around to see what other books there are about culture and the workplace out there. It's kind of a hot button issue right now on both positive and negative. And what we found was there are a lot of good books. Google has a good one. Zappos has a good one. The Ritz-Carlton has a good one. But all of those books focus on the story of that particular company. So we decided, instead of writing a book that's just about our company, what would happen if we wrote our story but augmented it with some research? And what if we interviewed 150 CEOs of companies that have won culture awards and start to look for some common best practices? So it isn't just the story of what William fell into along the way, but no, here's what we did and here's what we would do differently and here's what we actually got right. And that was sort of the cradle of a book that I really didn't want to write. I had a different book in my head, but my staff and my editor at Forbes and several others just kept encouraging, hey, you need to get this out there. And so the hesitant writer got to work, and here we are today.
All right. So just so people heard you correctly, hey, you guys, I know sometimes you hear culture wars and you hear people refer to that. He's talking about culture awards. He's talking about winning awards in for the culture that we're cultivating, for the culture that people are recognizing in our workspaces and in our businesses. William, one of the things I love about the book is that even if you're not a business owner, if you're a church leader, if you're the leader of a family, there is information in here that can be adapted and translated really for any environment. I mean, I appreciate that it's really designed for consumption by CEOs and their teams, by human resource directors, and maybe by, I like the way that you describe it, as maybe by a young person in an organization who has the ear of the CEO. I do think that those are the kinds of people who are going to really love the Culture Wins book. But I also feel like, you know, it's not just businesses that are that sort of recognize they have a culture problem, and that's why they have a, let's say, church hopping problem, where businesses have job hopping problems. Mm. And so, you know, I felt like there's just lots of really rich material here for those who are, you know, serving in nonprofit organizations. People in leadership, really, of any variety can really benefit. So, again, friends, the book is Culture Wins. The author is William Vanderblumen of the Vanderblumen Search Group. Hey, William, you say right off in here that that every culture, every company has a culture, every company has a baseline culture. And when I read that, I thought, well, maybe we're talking about language, the way people dress, punctuality, kitchen etiquette, like is it okay to cook fish in the kitchen at the workplace, whether or not our doors are closed or open, whether or not we even have doors, you know, are we friends outside of work? Is that the kind of thing you're talking about when you talk about the baseline culture of a company, or are you talking about something else?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. What I think we discovered, so we started winning all these awards. We won, you know, sixth best place to work in Houston, and then the next year, third best. And then Entrepreneur gave us top company culture, and then we won best office space. And then, because Texans love superlatives, we won best office dog in the city of Houston, which is hilarious. But, you know, in the middle of all that, we're like, why are we winning? We don't have, like, I think fun culture, and I think of video arcade games in the break room and endless food and sliding boards instead of staircases and all the things you'd imagine in Silicon Valley. We have IKEA furniture, and most of our people put their own desk together. So, you know, what is it that's causing us to win? And what I realized was there are really two pieces to a workplace culture. One is the what do we do that's common to us that's uncommon to others around us, like the very unique, only you, don't copy anybody else. This is our particular thumbprint. But underneath that, there's a base layer. And fundamentally, it's how do we treat each other? You know, what I realized is we had a little bit of a head start against other corporations and companies in the U.S. because we're a faith-based organization, and we're not perfect people by any stretch at all. I mean, I am way far from a finished product. But there is a commitment to trying to live by a higher code than the rest of the world. And that immediately, go figure, when you follow the principles God's laid out, it creates a better workplace. So what we did was we said, well, we've got this head start. What are the baseline things that would say, is this a healthy place to work or a toxic place to work? Some of it is as simple as how do we communicate with one another? Other pieces may not sound Christian, but they really are. For instance, we found eight key areas of baseline health. One is innovation. Have we done anything new lately? You say, well, that's not Christian. Yes, it is. How do the scriptures begin? God creates. God's always making a new thing. And in a workplace where there's nothing new happening, things go stagnant and eventually get toxic. So we identified these eight areas, and they're in a chapter in the book. And, you know, my team being the incredible people they are, they said, that's not enough, William. We don't need the chapter. We need to develop a tool that people could use to find out whether or not their workplace is healthy or toxic. And so because we have amazing people and tools to build these kind of things, we were able to create a free online assessment for people to be able to take either as an individual so they can see how they feel about their workplace or as a whole team to find out anonymous, you know, sort of 360.
All right, friends, we got to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be rejoined by William Vanderblumen of the Vanderblumen Search Group, and we'll continue our conversation about culture wins. Hey, friends, send a prayer out again to our friends in Superior, Wisconsin. There's a, you know, 11 folks injured yesterday in the Husky plant explosion. Just want to continue in our prayers for them. This is Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. We'll be right back. Hey, friends, this is Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Some days the stress of what we're doing runs really high. Other days the stress is really positive because we love what we're doing and we want to pursue with excellence the opportunities that the Lord has set before us. So we're having that kind of conversation today with William Vanderblumen. William is the, well, he started and he is still the shepherd, CEO of Vanderblumen Search Group. And if you are in a big church, there is every likelihood that he or someone in his group helped you in your church not only discover your culture, but find the leaders who are currently serving you. So that's what they do at Vanderblumen Search Group for not only churches, but other faith-based organizations. William is a friend in ministry. He is a pastor, a speaker, an entrepreneur, and an author. And today he's joining us to talk about his latest book, which is Culture Wins. Hey, William, just before the break, we were talking about a free online resource, the Culture Index, that you all provide for individuals and groups who want to, you know, examine their own culture. Can you finish up that thought? Because we dropped off right before the break.
Yeah, sure, Carmen. I was just saying we built a free online assessment where you can go take a very short individual quiz and just get a first impression of how you feel about your workplace. Is it healthy or is it toxic? And then your whole team can take it, and you can just go to the website theculturetool.com, like T-O-O-L, theculturetool.com, and totally free as an individual and as a group. There's a free version of the report, and hopefully that'll help companies, churches, nonprofits start a conversation about what do we need to do better. You'll see how you scored against yourself, where you're strong and where you're weak, and you'll also see how you scored against the field of hundreds and hundreds of companies that have gone through this, everybody from big churches to Rudy's Barbecue that is all over Texas here to lots of faith-based businesses. So hope that's helpful.
Oh, that's very helpful. All right. So when we talk about culture wins, you use a roadmap as the discussion point here. So it's the roadmap to an irresistible workplace. But I'll have to admit to you, when I saw the cover, I did not think roadmap. I thought fuzzy, weird circles that don't look like they are leading me out of my current situation into, you know, something that is clear and clear steps to follow. So tell us about the roadmap concept, but then get us out of what, gosh, looks like we're just going to go around in circles.
It's a great question. We designed the cover. Well, we actually had someone design the cover. When it came back, we said, that's it. Because people say roadmap. Everybody wants to know. When we do a search for a pastor and we bring a short list of candidates back, people say, but who's the one? And can you give us a test score? Can you show us the exact route? Can you show us the exact way? And working with people is not an exact thing. It's an art, not a science. Culture in the workplace is made up of people. So it's an art, not a science. And what we've discovered is we don't have a cookie cutter for you to come up with a workplace culture, nor do we have a company that you should copy. What we do have is a story that can provide a roadmap. And the map is not one that leads you to some destination where you find your culture. No, the difference is you have a workplace culture. You say, no, we don't. We don't have anything written down. You have a workplace culture. If you've ever heard anyone say that's not the way we do things around here, that was your workplace culture right there. And so really the roadmap toward learning your culture, which we describe in the book, is a journey inward. It's a journey into the core of who you as an organization are, how you function, what's okay and what's not okay, where you're at your best and where you need to be better, and how you codify that and then memorialize it like we have with our nine values, which are literally plastered on the wall. They're tied to people's compensation. We hire through them. If we have to fire somebody, usually the culture values are a part of that. But we wouldn't be able to just decide on these eight values or seven values or nine values because they sound good. We had to go inside and discover what parts of how we work together is God using to cause us to do our very best work, and how do we memorialize that and try and maximize it. So the idea is, yes, it's a roadmap. It's not the same turns for everybody, and it's going to be a journey inward, not a journey to some other destination.
So I suspect that there's people listening right now, William, who are saying to themselves, I'm not sure I want the people in my workplace to tell me how much or how little they like their job, or how much or how little they appreciate how they're treated at work. I don't want to use the word danger, because in my view, it's all really good growth and good learning. But there's danger here if you know that you are the leader of a toxic organization, and that part of the reason that it's toxic is you. So can you just talk to leaders who sort of recognize that they're going to have to change in order for the place where they lead to become healthy?
Well, I would say, you know, depending on the age of the organization, this statement has more or less weight. The younger an organization, not younger by age of employees, but younger by how long it's been around, the younger the organization, the more closely the culture is tied to the top five people in the organization. Now, even in an organization that's been around hundreds of years, the top five people in the organization still have a very large bearing on the culture, but not as much as if they'd started the company. So that's all that's to say, if you want to make a radical change in the culture of your workplace, it probably requires a radical change in the people at the top. And that's not good news. I don't like hearing that. You're right. It is dangerous. You may just throw me off the air for saying this, but I got a couple years left before I turn 50. But I got to tell you, I'm not looking forward to my physical exam once I hit 50, because as a guy, it gets to be invasive and not fun. But the alternative is to not get checked and have a real problem later. Okay. So I think the wise leaders will go ahead and take their medicine, get an anonymous assessment of how they're doing, not just ask for emails like, how do you think it's going, but something like theculturetool.com, or there are others out there that would just allow them to have a clean 360 look at how are things going, what do we need to work on. And usually when you see what you need to work on, the first step of a wise leader is to look in the mirror. It's a lot like getting logs out of our own eye before pulling splinters out of the employees.
So I love that, first of all, as a biblical image and a reminder to all of us that, you know, a good long look in the mirror is important. And actually, we can learn a lot. We can learn a lot about not only ourselves, but the environment that we're creating around us, the culture we're contributing to, by taking a look at ourselves. I was reminded a few minutes ago when you talked about innovation. Because I do think that when we're talking about leading change, and we're talking about not only leading change in our businesses, but leading change, let's say, in our churches, and we're talking about innovation, that line that you surface there, you know, that's just not the way we do it around here, or we've never done it that way before. Those do indicate the culture that we're in and the culture that we're a part of. And yet innovation requires that we get beyond those hurdles or barriers to change in the culture. And I was thinking, when you were talking about innovation in relationship to, you know, sort of where are you going to put that? I was thinking, you know, where Jesus talks about you can't put new wine in old wineskins. Why? Because it becomes toxic, because it spoils. And so you can't put these innovative new things in a cultural system that is going to spoil them. We'll actually take those innovations and turn them toxic. So anyway, I just offer that up to you. Hey,
I used to think it was like an op-ed Jesus was writing about wine and wineskins. He wasn't like offering an opinion.
That's true.
And I'm going off topic just a little bit, but, you know, some years back I'm getting to an age where I have to stretch after I run or I end up injured. And so it's hard for me. I'm not very good at it. So I was sitting stretching and sweating harder trying to touch my toes than I did on the run. And our, at the time, 3-year-old walked in and looked at me sitting there struggling. And she sat down in the floor and she tied herself in a human pretzel like only a toddler can do. And then she got up and looked at me again, didn't say a word, just laughed out loud and left the room. You know, totally laughed at me. And I realized right then, the teachable moment was, every day I'm alive, I get less flexible. And that's true for organizations too. We naturally move toward rigidity, and culture hinges on being flexible. So it requires a really concerted effort. It's not easy work.
Okay, I love that. Hey, because it's one of my favorite stories, will you tell the family trip story to Hawaii a few years back?
We have 150 children. It's not quite true, but we have 7 children, and we're a blended family, and we all flew to Hawaii for spring break. I travel a lot for work, so I have a bunch of points. Unfortunately, if you use points to fly to Hawaii, it usually means you're landing at midnight or later. You get the sort of crummy flight. And so we flew out there, and we landed, and I'm getting the rental cars, because you have to do that when you're a family of 9. And they say, oh, mahalo. And they say, you know, by the way, watch out for the tsunami warning. And I said, that's really funny, because, you know, in the mainland, we say there's a tornado watch. We watch for tornadoes. But then when somebody's seen one, they say, now the tornado's coming, so now it's a tornado warning. And he said, oh, same thing. There's a tsunami coming. I'm like, what? And this earthquake had gone off in Japan. This was 8 or 9 years ago, so listeners might remember it. And there was a tsunami headed right toward us. Like, we were the evac spot. And things worked out fine, other than trying to get toddlers and young children to sleep when they're saying, so they're going to come in our hotel room to get us. And that was a little bit of a nightmare. But the takeaway was, so many trends that happen in the workplace start like an earthquake in Japan, and then a wave is headed towards you, and it gets there before you realize it's coming. We found that with succession. When we wrote a book about succession, there is a earthquake has gone off, and it's called the baby boomers are retiring. Same's true with culture. They're retiring fast, and there's a wave coming, and it's a wave of a new workforce full of millennials, which means the rules are going to change. We go into a lot of that in the book. It's almost like if you can see where the earthquake went off and see the wave coming, you can get ahead. And the hope is that with this book, whether it's a church or a nonprofit or a faith-based business, by reading this book, they can see a wave coming before it hits and really have a competitive advantage in whatever mission they're trying to get accomplished.
So as I reread that in this book, I thought to myself, wow, I think that there are not people thinking about the earthquake of artificial intelligence. There are people not thinking about the earthquake and then therefore the tsunami related to automation. We're not thinking about Africa. We're not thinking about the fact that everybody 10 and under in America is now minority white. Like, there's all kinds of trends in the culture that a lot of us, we're just doing what we do every day, kind of literally going through the motions of whatever it is that keeps our family moving along. And we're not stepping back and taking the time to survey what's happening halfway around the world or on the other side of the country, or frankly, even within the cultural systems of which we are a part. So I want to thank you for Culture Wins. I think it's an excellent book. Friends, it's Culture Wins, The Roadmap to an Irresistible Workplace. But I'll tell you, it's translatable to every cultural system of which you are a part, and certainly important if you are a person in leadership in any of those cultures, be it the home, be it the workplace, be it the church, be it a nonprofit, on and on and on. So, William Vanderblumen, thank you so much. It's Vanderblumen Search Group. You can follow William on Twitter at @WVanderblumen. You can follow the firm at Vanderblumen SG for Vanderblumen Search Group. And where is the best place to go online? We're going to send them to theculturetool.com, but where else do you want them to go?
Well, I think the easiest thing is just to Google the word Vanderblumen, and you can honestly misspell it 100 different ways, and people will get there. It's why we chose the name we did. It's not some need for me to be memorialized. And what you'll find there, no matter what kind of organization you're leading, you'll find roughly 2,000 free resources on how to run, recruit, keep your team, just things we have learned along the way that we like to hand out to people for free. And maybe one day we work together or not, but I think it'd be helpful for your listeners just to Google Vanderblumen and go to Vanderblumen.com. All that social media information, books, everything is right there in one spot.
Love it. Hey, William, thank you so much.
Thanks, Carmen. Love what you're doing, and I appreciate you having me on.
Thanks, man. All right, friends, we got to take one more quick break. I'm Carmen LaBurge. This is Connecting Faith. We'll be right back. Carmen LaBurge, you're listening to Connecting Faith. I was just enjoying the music, and I kind of forgot I was supposed to be talking. So, sorry about that. Hey, welcome back. We're at this time in the program where we make the connecting point. And it's not really that I'm trying to tie it all up in a bow. I'm really trying to give you some talking points for the day ahead and now for the weekend ahead. So maybe I'll just start here, and a larger conversation about culture. Because when we talk with William Vanderblumen about the idea of culture wins, what that really means is that whether you want to admit it or not, every environment of which you are a part, like, it has its own culture. It has its morals, its values, its trends, its habits, its expectations, its language. I mean, culture has all of those things. And And you know, when you walk into, let's say, an environment that's culturally very different than the culture with which you are most familiar or most comfortable. So we talk about the differences in cultures when we travel, but I'm not sure that we recognize just how different the culture might be in a workplace, one workplace to another. And so you might have expectations of a culture because of the first place that you worked. And so you think every workplace is like the first place that you worked. Well, come to find out, that's just not true. So my husband, I can say this on an Arbor Day. That's Happy Arbor Day, by the way. If you haven't planted a tree yet today, there's still time to get out there and do it. My husband owns a tree service company. And so I've learned a lot more about trees in the last 7 years than I probably ever thought I would know before that. But the culture of a tree service company, you know, depending on who's running it, is very, very different. And so Golden Rule Tree Service, which is Jim's company, is run by the Golden Rule. Like, he leads with that and he talks with his guys about that. And guys who come from other tree service companies, they have not always had that experience. And so the way they have been treated and the way they have learned to treat other people sometimes needs some intervention and some refinement when they join Golden Rule. And sometimes they're not able to adapt to the Golden Rule culture, in which case they don't get to stay in the Golden Rule culture, because it's a high value here that we treat other people as, in fact, we would want to be treated. And so culture is not the enemy. Culture is the reality that we cultivate. And so if you think of where God set us originally at creation, you know, God placed us in a garden. Well, that's an environment of cultivation, and it's a place where culture takes place. And so culture is this garden in which God has placed us, over which God has set us as his managers, into which God sends us to cultivate a harvest of righteousness for his own glory. He expects us to be people who are literally working the culture. And so from the roots to the fruits of our culture, whatever that is, the culture of our home, the culture of our workplace, the culture of our church, the culture writ large, from the roots to the fruits, in the culture in which God has planted us, we are accountable to God. From the roots to the fruits. So if you don't like the fruits of unrighteousness that are being produced in the culture of which you are a part, it's your job to till that soil. It's your job as God's ambassador and God's steward in that particular environment. It's your job to remake that culture in the image of Christ. And you say, well, that sounds like an awful lot of work. Yes, it is an awful lot of work. It's painstaking work. If you have ever tried to grow anything, you know that the soil has to be tilled. And sometimes that soil has become so hardened and so impacted and neglected for so long that tilling it up the first time is really, really challenging. And there's often rocks that have to be removed. I had a conversation with a friend who they've been gardening this same plot of ground on their land for years and years and years. And she says it never fails. Every single year when you till the soil, there's new rocks to get out of, you know, out of the garden. And we've been setting them on the edge. And she's like, you know, now there's like a wall on the edge of the garden. Well, the garden wall is actually the rocks that over time have grown in the garden. And you say to yourself, how is it that my garden grows rocks? I don't actually know. They come up from underneath the more we till. And so there you go. Maybe you need to be removing the rocks in the garden, in the culture garden where God currently has you placed. So we've got a culture in our home. We've got a culture in our workplace. We've got the culture of the classroom. We got the culture of our community, certainly the culture of our country. And you and I also have these social media environments. Generations before us did not have those particular cultural environments in which they engaged. And so we have this new culture of social media that we have to figure out how to cultivate as well. So I want to ask you today, how are you tilling the cultural soil in each one of those spheres of influence? What are you sowing? The seed, you know, what seeds are you sowing in the culture of your home or in the culture of your workplace? And when the fruit inspector drops by to check production levels, Is the fruit inspector going to find an increasing yield in both quality and quantity? Now, here I'm talking about, you know, the list in Galatians 5. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, generosity, and self-control. Is there going to be quality and quantity of fruit production and an increasing yield in every single one of those areas? Maybe just ask it this way. How's the harvest of righteousness going in your particular garden? Check the soils. You know, have a conversation about the seed. What are you sowing? There's all kinds of parables of Jesus to turn to here. We got the wheat and the tares growing up together. We got, two brothers sent out into the field. One says, I'm not going to go. The other says, I'm going to go. But the reverse actually happens. The one that says he isn't going to go ends up going. The one who says he's going to go doesn't go. Are you actually going into the cultural realities where Christ is sending you, where God has called you? The harvest is plentiful. The laborers are few. Pray that God will send us out. Well, God has sent us out. And then I guess comes the question, do you think that working the soil, tilling the soil, getting your hands dirty in this cultural cultivation business, cultural engagement, this is beneath you? I mean, maybe that's what's going on. Some people just think, you know, they're just kind of too good to get engaged with the culture. We reap what we sow, friends. So if you don't like the harvest of unrighteousness in the culture of your home or your workplace or your classroom or your community or the culture at large, then it's time to start tilling and removing the rocks and enriching the soil and sowing the seed and hedging against pests, praying for God's favor, and then doing the hard work of harvesting when God gives the growth. Gardening and farming require great faith and great patience and hard work. My guess is we got listeners right now who are nodding their heads up and down. Like sometimes we pray for rain and sometimes we pray for the rain to stop. So friends, we actually have to like get out there into the culture if we really want to influence it. So immediately following today's episode, I'm going to invite you to join me on Facebook Live because there's a story this just needs our attention. And I feel like as Christians, we've got to be prepared to respond to the very public failure of America's dad, Bill Cosby, and one of America's most beloved pastors, Bill Hybels. And I want to do that, and I want to do it carefully, and I sort of want to do it by eyeballing you. And so if you want to join me immediately following today's Connecting Faith program on Facebook Live, you can just go to Facebook and find the page for Reconnect with Carmen. And I'll be live there just after the top of the hour to have a conversation about how, as Christians, we can respond to the very public failure of leaders whom we have grown to love and respect. All right, friends, you can find out more about what's going on through all the programs and ministries of My Faith Radio at myfaithradio.com. You can log on there and you can check out all of the programs that are available. And there's lots of extra resources there, ministry resources. You can ask for prayer. I'm just going to tell you that every week at our Faith Radio staff meeting, we pray by name for those who share their prayer concerns with us. Some people call in to 877-93-FAITH and share their prayer concern. Or their appreciation for what they've heard on Faith Radio, something that has touched your life, something that has actually helped you, connect faith to life in important ways. If you want to share that with us, we would love to hear your feedback at 877-93-FAITH. Again, we got all kinds of things going on. We got a writer's contest. We got a writer's conference, all kinds of cool stuff. So log on to myfaithradio.com and check it all out. Hey, if you want to join me on Facebook, I'll be there live just after the top of the hour. That's all we got time for here on Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBerge. Have a great weekend and God bless. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.